Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It is Friday, February 5th, 2021, and every week we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news and analysis on books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me today. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So, Andrew, sales figures are in for the last week of January, and is it fair to say that 2021 is picking up right where 2020 left off as far as strong book sales?
I think it is indeed fair to say that. Sales of print books were up 19.5% in the week that ended January 30th of 2021. That, of course, is over the comparable week in 2020. And this is at outlets that report to NPD BookScan. And this is the third consecutive week unit sales have increased by at least 19% over 2020 numbers. For the first month of January, print unit sales are up a hefty 21.3%. And as has been the case for most of January, sales are up by double digits in all the major categories. Kids and YA kind of pace the field here, but adult fiction continues to post solid gains. Adult nonfiction rose about 13% over last week. And this was led by, I think, the release of Cicely Tyson's memoir, Just As I Am, which sold more than 45,000 copies in its first week on sale. And of course, sadly, Cicely Tyson recently passed away.
Headline news in corporate America this week is that Jeff Bezos is stepping down as Amazon CEO. The e-commerce giant began life in 1994 as an online bookseller.
Yeah, big news this week. Tucked into Amazon's fourth quarter announcements, Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos is going to turn over his CEO duties to Andy Jassy, who is currently the head of Amazon Web Services. And that's going to happen sometime in this year's third quarter. Bezos is going to become the executive chairman of Amazon. In a statement, Bezos said that Amazon has become the company it is because of innovation. I'll quote him here. When you look at our financial results, what you're actually seeing are the long-term cumulative results of invention, he said. Right now, I see Amazon at its most inventive ever, making this an optimal time for this transition. To which I'd say, yeah, that's one way to look at this move.
So you think there could be another way to look at the Bezos exit?
Well, my view is kind of this, and it's in a nutshell, it's, hey, let's let Andy Jassy deal with it. And, you know, Congress and regulators and all the haters around the world, hey, let Andy handle it. Remember, we live in a relatively digital world now, right? Competition is increasingly fierce. So perfect time to let Andy deal with it. If you're Jeff Bezos, I mean, think of it this way. If you're Jeff Bezos and you've built one of the biggest companies in the history of the world, and you have more personal wealth than half the country combined, and your company has the economy of the size of a small country, at some point you have to think maybe it's time to try something else. Maybe you'll have a little more fun, do something else that you've always been interested in. And I say that especially now because Amazon is at this enormous size and at this point in its life cycle where I think it's less about growing and more about defending the company from being torn apart. And that can't be a lot of fun. I mean, if you're Jeff Bezos, do you really want to spend your day to day talking to lawyers and listening how to defend your company in Congress or hustling for new markets? I say let Andy Jassy do it. And as for the idea that Amazon was built on innovation and invention, well, no doubt that was certainly true at the outset, and it is certainly true to some degree now. You know, Amazon was really innovative in the time, you know, when we all used Alta Vista to search the web and Netscape. But the argument we hear from many people now, including coming from Congress, is sort of an age-old tale, right? Companies get involved to solve a problem, but over time they become sort of invested in the problem they set out to solve. In other words, Amazon may be a little more invested in preserving the markets it now dominates through acquisitions or other hardball tactics rather than through the kind of bold innovation they were initially built on. And let's be honest here, there are all kinds of stories out there about Amazon's strong arm tactics and acquisitions and retaliation. There's a lawsuit right now in the publishing realm where you know they're alleging conspiracy to fix ebook prices. But this is not just in the book business. This is across all of Amazon's business. And also, I think Amazon's power has become more apparent, this especially to regulators, and more troublesome, I think, to lawmakers during the pandemic, which, of course, has been very good for Amazon as small businesses have been forced to close their stores and online shopping has taken on new importance. Indeed, overshadowed a bit in the analyst call in which Bezos announced his impending departure, the numbers show just how dominant Amazon has become. The stock price has, of course, surged, and fourth quarter sales jumped 44%. For 2020, while sales for the full year rose 38% over 2019, they hit a staggering $386.1 billion.
Do you think Bezos stepping down will have any impact at all on the book business, Andrew? He may have opened Amazon 27 years ago as a digital bookstore, but as you say, it's far from that today.
Yeah, it's hard to see how this would have any real impact on the book business. You know, book selling, as you say, was how Amazon got its start, but it's just a tiny part of what Amazon does now. In fact, the only mention of the book business in the analyst call for the year-end results was tied to the self-publishing business. And that was interesting news. It was reported that more than 1,000 authors using Kindle Direct Publishing had royalties surpassing $100,000 in 2020. And in all the authors who use KDP earned more than $370 million in royalties from their participation in the subscription service Kindle Unlimited for the year. So those are big numbers and certainly point to success in the self-publishing realm. But, you know, it's the new business that CEO Andy Jassy currently runs, which is the web services division that is the company's most profitable operation. Oh, and I should also mention, looking ahead to the end of the current quarter, the first quarter of 2021, Amazon shows no signs of slowing down. Sales are predicted to jump 33 to 40% over last year's first quarter. So a lot of growth yet to come for Amazon.
You mentioned the work of regulators. When it comes to big tech companies, it does seem to be momentum building to regulate or even break them up. And that impulse is spilling into publishing. Just after we recorded last week's podcast, the Authors Guild, along with five other writers groups, made public a letter laying out their opposition to the deal, seeing Penguin Random House purchase rival Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, the Authors Guild and the nonprofit Open Markets, as well as a few other groups, last week made public a letter that is sent to the Department of Justice asking for the government to block Penguin Random House's pending acquisition of Simon & Schuster. I'll quote from it here. "The time has come to recognize that simply blocking takeovers is no longer sufficient," the letter reads. "The Department of Justice must now begin to proactively restructure the entire U.S. market for books in ways that also deal with the danger posed by Amazon." Now, I don't know about you, but I find that to be just an astonishing statement. I mean, think about that. The Authors Guild is calling for the government restructuring of the book business. I mean, that's just a stunning statement. And I think it, you know, if I can, you know, say my own feelings here, not speaking for Publishers Weekly, I think it sort of undercuts the effectiveness of its own message, to be honest. We can come back to that later. I'll go on to say that the letter makes some decent points about how Amazon's supposed monopoly power poses a variety of threats to authors, publishers, indie booksellers and readers, and even American democracy itself. And they say that the answer is not to allow publishers to get bigger on their side. The organizations contend that the combination of Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster, which brings together the first and the third largest trade book publishers in the country, will diminish competition for authors' manuscripts, drive down author advances, and they also make an argument that I'm not really a fan of, which is the publishing industry's role in protecting free speech. PRH has, of course, countered that even with the addition of Simon & Schuster, its market share would still be below the level that would trigger antitrust regulatory action, although it isn't all that clear what data anyone is basing any of these claims on or what data regulators are going to use to measure the market or what the relevant markets are going to be. Penguin Random House maintains that PRH and SNS editors are going to be independent. They're going to be allowed to compete for the same manuscripts. You have to wonder about that, though, right? If the same person at the top is signing off, you have to wonder if there's not going to be some coordination along the line somewhere.
Why do you think the statement about the need for DOJ to restructure the book market diminishes the impact of the whole letter?
Quite simply because there's no way to accomplish that. And I think you look a little foolish to suggest such a thing. I mean, it's one thing to say that Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster would be too big. And I think the letter makes a compelling argument on that score. For example, Amazon's letter argues that, you know, Amazon's market power does pose a variety of threats, but the Bertelsmann solution of creating a countervailing monopoly is not the solution. Okay, solid argument there. Go ahead, DOJ, jump in, reject the deal, put some conditions on. but restructure the entire U.S. book business so authors can get higher advances? I know I'm sorry, but at this point in publishing history, that's just, that sounds nuts to me. Now, I agree that consolidation is an issue, but there are so many more business practices that impact the book market than size right now, especially in the digital age. And, you know, look, I hate to use a sports metaphor here. I know certain people that cringe at them, but in baseball, if you come into the bottom of the ninth down by 10 runs, you need base runners. You can't hit a 10-run home run. So the idea of the DOJ, after years of letting the market just do its thing and consolidate, now needs to come in and restructure the book business. Well, to me, that's swinging for a 10-run home run. And I'd also point out that this suggestion is in tension with the Guild's other central thesis, which is that the deal will hurt freedom of speech, potentially hurt American democracy. You know, if you believe books are imperative to free speech, which they are, and you fear for freedom of speech in this country, which is always a valid fear, how exactly does having the government come in and restructure and regulate the marketplace of ideas work? Yeah, let's ask Bill Barr to get right on that. I mean, thankfully, Bill Barr is no longer at the DOJ, but you see my point.
Now, Andrew, I know you to be a strong defender of free speech. You've made that point many times in the program in the past, but you don't think that concern applies in the case of mergers and antitrust. Why exactly?
Yeah, you know, I am a staunch defender of free speech. Absolutely. And I do worry about the state of the publishing business, too, and Amazon and the major publishers and all of that, and indie publishers. So I don't want this to all overshadow the fact that much of what the Guild letter puts forth is quite valid. And a lot of it strikes me as very true, including the idea that we really need to step up our antitrust enforcement in this country. But I'll go back to something that antitrust expert Chris Sager said to me a while back, because it strikes me as true. Chris, of course, is a professor at the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. And what he told me is that the consolidation in publishing is an honest-to-goodness marketplace issue. There's no need to stretch it into a marketplace of ideas issue. Free speech happens in so many forums. And free speech, and what that means, involves so much care and so much reason and thoughtfulness that conflating this issue, which is sort of the bedrock value of publishing companies and sagging advance payments of authors, in an industry that in many ways is struggling to adapt to this new digital world, making this all about democracy, I fear, just invites trouble. And, you know, sure, the consolidation in the publishing industry brushes up against potential free speech issues, but I think we're better off keeping this issue grounded in ensuring that the marketplace is fair and level. You know, I'd agree we've not done very well in that regard and that we need to do better. But I don't think the good people at Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster, nor the people at Amazon, have any interest in diminishing the free and robust exchange of ideas.
Well, Andrew Albanese, thank you for joining me today for another round of free and robust exchange here on our program. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer. Thank you, and we'll speak to you next week.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, with COVID-19 accelerating the pressure to publish open and to adopt sustainable open access business models, transformative agreements present significant strategic and management challenges for publishers. A panel discussion in December for STM Week 2020 explored how these agreements can become a test of data quality. Sybil Geisenhainer, Director, Open Science Strategy and Licensing at ACS Publications, described her core principles for negotiating transformative agreements.
Here at the ACS, we actually developed for ourselves a set of principles where we think we should not try to lose, to focus on our ways to a transformative agreement. And to communicate those right at the beginning, if you enter into negotiations, is very important from our perspective. And just to mention a couple out of those principles, those are, for example, that the researcher and the author is really key for us and should be the first one supported by such agreements. And another point, for example, is to make those deals sustainable, also from a perspective for society, and so we can sustain our mission in the future. This is very important. And also for us to go into those partnerships, we think it is important that both sides really recognize the value and appreciate the role of society publishers in scholarly communication.
Transformative Models for Scholarly Publishing, next on this CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.